This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. Well, the primary is finally behind us, and the November ballot is set. Texas Republicans chose Ken Paxton to face James Talrico for the U.S. Senate in the fall. West Texas opted for Tom Sell in the race to fill the Senate that is being vacated by Jody Arrington. We've invited our regular commentator, Paul Fabrizio, to come in and break down the outcome of this runoff election. Paul, once again, thank you for joining us here.
Oh, it's good to be here. Thank you so much, George.
President Trump endorsed several candidates on Texas Republican runoff ballot. The big one, Paxton, defeated the senior Senator Cornyn, who'd been there for a long time, 2002. Over the last few weeks, the polls kind of close-ish, and then Paxton got that endorsement.
And jumped. He won by about 25 points, and
wow,
that was a real surprise. You know, you look at the polls before, and for the most part, they showed Paxton with a decent lead. There was even one poll that showed him, it was an internal Paxton poll, that showed him up by 17 points. But then the Trump endorsement came, and everything enlarged. So a lot of us expected Paxton to win. We just didn't expect him to win overwhelmingly. The Texas voters have said to John Cornyn, thank you very much for your service. Get out of here.
Which is interesting because, you know, not everybody agreed with Cornyn, but I don't know that you would call him a divisive figure in the Republican Party.
No. He's taken a couple of controversial stands. For example, he came out with some gun control measures after the Uvalde shootings.
Right.
But other than that, he has been a standard Republican conservative, and he has, for the most part, supported the president's agenda, and he has tried really hard to tie himself to President Trump. I mean, the first campaign stop that John Cornyn went to when he began his reelection campaign was to Trump Burgers. Okay? I mean, you're trying to make a statement then that you're tight. Donald Trump, however, rebuffed him. And when push came to shove, chose Ken Paxton. He went with 100% loyalty, even though we got to admit that Ken Paxton has never had the occasion to vote on any of the issues that Donald Trump cares about.
Never had to prove that loyalty.
He's never had to prove it, whereas John Cornyn actually had to live it.
One more question on that topic, and that is this. Now that Cornyn is a lame duck, he's out in November, right?
I mean, yes. He's out. His last day will be January 2nd.
So he's out in January. Is he going to be lockstep in with the president from now until January?
If you listen to Cornyn's statement last night after the election loss, he said that he's a Republican. He's going to support the Republican ticket. However, how much will he do that? How enthusiastic will he do it? And that we just don't know. If you look at some of the other Republicans who supported Donald Trump, but Trump did not endorse them, like, for example, Bill Cassidy over in Louisiana,
right.
Tom Tillis is another one. What you see is an independence from the president. So let's see if John Cornyn does that now.
Do you remember another time in our nation's history when being entirely lockstep with the president meant that much? Like, did you ever have to be so in tune with the president to get elected?
Yeah, there was a time, and that was after the Great Depression began with Franklin D. Roosevelt. And
He
did not demand the absolute obedience that President Trump is demanding, but he certainly made sure that he picked his friends. And if you were one of his friends, you were going to be okay. So there was that element of being a kingmaker with FDR.
That is some interesting perspective.
But since then, we really haven't had anybody with that kind of power.
Well, let's shift and talk about 19. West Texas Republicans, they want Tom Sell to be their candidate heading to the general election. He claimed a decisive victory yesterday, 2/3 of the vote. He far outraced his challenger. What do you think made the difference for him? Was it the money?
I think it was the money. You got to remember that this is a big district. It goes from Lubbock to Big Spring to Abilene. It covers a lot of territory, 800,000 people in the district. How do you get known? None of these two candidates were known before this campaign got going. So you've got to get out there. You've got to get your name in front of voters. Both of them tied themselves to Donald Trump.
They did.
And so it's really hard to come up with what's the difference between the two. But it came down, I think, to name recognition. Tom Sell was much more effective at fundraising. Last numbers I saw, $1.5 million he raised. Abraham Enriquez, only about $500,000.
Tom Sell told KACU last night that he doesn't plan to change his campaign style as he shifts gears into the race against Democrat Kyle Rabel.
We just wanted to run a kind of a distinctly positive race. It's kind of different from much of the political culture that we know these days. And, I want West Texas to be a real light for the entire nation in that way. So, we're going to continue to do the work. There'll be a greater distinction, obviously, between what the Democratic Party stands for and what the Republican Party does. I'm excited to get into those debates.
Kyle Rabel, who describes himself as an LBJ yellow dog Democrat in November, is who he will face. It's been a long time since a Democrat has served in Congress from this region. What kind of campaign do you expect to see between those two?
I actually expect to see it come down to fundraising again. Yeah. And Tom Sell's got the money. He's going to raise money, some more money. He's going to get his name out in front of the voters more and more and more. And this election has all the makings of being a Democratic election. That's going to help Rabel. But we're a district that's 70% to 80% Republican.
Right.
So even if it's a wave election, you can knock 10 points off the Republican, you still have a landslide for the Republican candidate. So Rabel has a really tough time ahead. He needs a ton of money. He needs to get his name out, and he needs to present himself as authentically West Texan against a candidate who everybody admits is West Texan and has a lot more money. It's just going to be really, really difficult.
It's interesting that he brands himself as a yellow dog Democrat. And last week on the West Texas Dispatch, Tom Sell told the Dispatch that he learned a lot from working with Stenholm, which was interesting, a yellow dog Democrat, of course. So almost reaching across the aisle in that one.
Right. And that's what's interesting about Tom Sell is that there's this element about him that's establishment Republican, whereas Abraham Enriquez was totally MAGA.
Yeah.
But Tom Sell doesn't talk about it much, but there's this element of him being an old style Republican willing to work across the aisle. Is he going to emphasize that in this election, or is he going to focus on the fact that he stands with Donald Trump? It's really difficult to see any way that he would lose this election.
I'm going to be very honest. We could talk to you for another couple of hours, Paul Fabrizio, but we're all out of time. Paul Fabrizio, thank you for joining us on the West Texas Dispatch.
Thank you. It's so good to be here with you, George.
Paul Fabrizio, recently retired political science, now political science professor emeritus at McMurray University, regular political commentator here at the West Texas Dispatch. Brace yourself. There are still 160 days until the November midterm elections. This week, we're wrapping up our month-long deep dive, looking at how Texas is reshaping the way the justice system responds to mental illness, with a series entitled Minds on Trial. The first four episodes looked at the problem, the solutions, the models, and the people living inside it. This week in episode 5, KACU's Josiah Wannell steps back and asks the question underneath all the others, not how we respond to mental illness, but how we see it, and whether the way we've always seen it is part of the problem.
Dr. Andy Keller has spent his career at the Meadows Mental Health Policy Institute, doing something that sounds simple, but has proven extraordinarily difficult.
Yeah. Well, so our mission, our goal is to basically help treatment for mental illnesses like these to be at least as good as treatment for cancer or heart disease. And so that's a journey. So like it used to be that when you had heart disease, we didn't treat you until your heart, until you had a heart attack, until your heart stopped. Like that was when my grandpa got diagnosed with his heart disease, was when they woke him up after resuscitating him from being dead.
He is not speaking abstractly. That was the standard of care. Wait for the crisis, then respond.
And that's a lot how we do it right now with mental illness. Like we don't go out there till there's a crisis.
Judge Steve Lifeman, after 30 years on the bench in Miami-Dade County and a career spent at the center of this issue, expresses the same diagnosis as Dr. Keller with less tolerance.
If someone has a heart attack on the side of the street, we're not going to walk over them and pretend it didn't happen. We're going to call 911. An EMT is going to get sent to the scene. They're going to get the best possible care. They may be unconscious. They'll be taken to a hospital. If they need emergency surgery, they're going to get involuntary treatment against their will. No one's asked. But God forbid you have a heart attack of the brain where you have a psychotic disorder. We're going to let you hang out on the street and watch your brain deficits increase by allowing your gray matter to get destroyed over a decade.
A heart attack of the brain. For Dr. Keller, that is the clinical reality of a psychotic break.
On average, it's 5 years later when we get care to people for these particular illnesses, 2 to 5, depending on what studies you look at.
5 years. In those 5 years, a person's illness advances. Their family exhausts itself. The criminal justice system accumulates the cost.
So today in the United States, 70% of people who are in jail either have a serious mental illness, a substance use disorder, or both.
Lifeman has arrived at what he considers the logical conclusion of that statistic.
I often joke, but it's not that funny, that maybe we need specialty courts for the 30% of people that don't have these disorders, and we need a therapeutic jurisprudence system for the 70% that do. Because just having small mental health courts that handle very few people does very little to curb the problem.
The brain is an organ. It gets sick. Judge Oscar Kazin of San Antonio has been making this argument at conference room tables in Bexar County for more than 20 years.
Just getting people to understand that having a mental health issue doesn't make you less than anybody else. And if they had a heart condition and I reached over and took the medication away from them, they would fight me to the death to have their heart medication back. But change that heart medication to mental health medication or psychotropics, and it's the other way around. They won't even acknowledge that they're ill. The mind is just another organ. It has its issues.
Eric Smith has thought about this more deeply than most because he has lived inside the answer.
When Alzheimer's and dementia hits, which is qualitatively different diagnosis from psychosis as I lived it, but the Venn diagram here, the overlap, is I could not perceive reality due to psychosis. Alzheimer's and dementia also prevents people from perceiving reality. But as a society, what do we say to Alzheimer's and dementia? We say, yeah, let's bring in the family in. Let's make sure we don't leave the loved one alone in the kitchen. If it gets to the point where like they can't drive temporarily or long-term, we'll need to do that. But everyone's brought in as a team approach, all working together for the benefit of the person suffering. But why? Because when I couldn't perceive reality, I was in my 20s. And so society up until AOT was essentially like, yeah, but he's a young man and he doesn't want treatment. Leave him alone.
Leave him alone. That was the operating principle. Not because anyone sat down and chose it, but because the cultural assumption underlying decades of mental health policy was that a young person who did not recognize their own illness and refused care was exercising a right rather than suffering a symptom.
Would you say that to an elderly person who could not perceive reality due to Alzheimer's and dementia? And if someone comes back and says, yeah, I also believe that we should leave people with Alzheimer's and dementia alone, I'll be like, I appreciate your consistency, but that is insane. We have to be able to help people who cannot help themselves. It is the strongest measure of society. No one's doing me or anyone else any favors to let us die on the street psychotic saying, well, they said they didn't want treatment. They said they didn't want treatment. We respected that. That's their choice.
And when someone does receive the care they need, when the system chooses to treat a brain the way it treats a heart, what happens? Judge Kazin answers that question.
Make wellness that habit. And once you do, amazing things happen.
1 week becomes a month becomes a year becomes, in some cases, a lifetime.
I couldn't have gotten to all of these fun, shinier, happier, pretty parts of my life without all of the chaos before it. And there is truly not a chance that I would have made it to where I'm at right now. Happy, healthy, filling a life of purpose and meaning without a huge team of people helping navigate through the chaos.
Eric Smith carries that message forward on behalf of every person whose story closely parallels his and who has chosen silence over exposure because the stigma still makes exposure dangerous.
Yeah, like I know there are a lot of Eric Smiths out there. Many of them are people I've met through the work that I do. It's just through necessity of what they do either professionally or personal preference that they don't want society knowing the ins and outs of everything they've been through and overcome, they're still very much living to themselves about it. I can't wait till we live in a time where people feel like they can share all of it as freely as we share diabetes, broken leg, high cholesterol, blood pressure issues, is just some other medical issue that is worthy of a more elegant solution.
The elegant solution exists. It has been demonstrated in Miami. It has been built in San Antonio. It has been legislated in Austin. The models are not theoretical. They are operational and documented. What remains is will, the public will to treat this as a health emergency.
And if you have any kind of soul at all, use what you have to help people.
The only question, the one Judge Kazin has been asking from the bench since before most people knew what assisted outpatient treatment was, the one Professor Shannon has been answering through legislation for more than 30 years, the one Eric Smith is willing to ask out loud while others stay quiet, is whether the rest of the country will listen. There are a lot of Eric Smiths. They are in your city. They are in rural West Texas, where the distance to help is measured in hours. They are in your family. You may not know it yet.
It is a human soul we're trying to save. How do we work together to get there?
That is not a rhetorical question. After the data, after the legislation, after 25 years of outcomes in Miami, in 2 decades of conference room tables in San Antonio, it is the main question that remains. The distance between a person in crisis and the help they need is no longer a matter of what is possible. It is a matter of will. I'm Josiah Winnell in Abilene.
Minds on Trial is a KACU original series created by Josiah Winnell. All 5 episodes are available on demand, kacu.org. This series was produced with assistance from the Public Media Journalists Association Editor Corps. That's funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. Out in the Big Bend area of Texas, the Trump administration's plans for border barriers are moving forward. Since it was first announced, the federal government has waived over 24 federal laws to fast-track construction across nearly 175 miles of rural West Texas. And as Carlos Morales reports, the plans have brought together an unusual bipartisan coalition united against the border wall.
On a quiet spring morning, Joe Pineda is driving across his family land near Redford, Texas.
Let me see. It's probably easier to go back this way.
He points to where he's grown alfalfa, pecan trees, and to the family cemetery that dates back to the late 1800s.
And here's the river.
Yeah,
let's get down and let's go look.
Take a look.
As Pineda looks over the Rio Grande, a gentle wind runs through overgrown reeds and mesquite trees. He thinks about the days he spent here as a child and the times he brought his own children here.
It's things like that that I'm going to miss. It's the time that you can enjoy with your kids and enjoy heritage of your land where your great-grandparents and everybody else before you lived, and it's going to be taken.
Pineda and his family have received a letter from the government warning of eminent domain proceedings if they don't sell the land or voluntarily give access for border wall construction. It's a scene playing out across the Big Bend as the government looks to build roughly 175 miles of border barrier. This area, one of the last pockets of untouched frontier country, is now set for 30-foot-tall steel fences, patrol roads, flood lighting, and surveillance systems. The plans have united Democrats and Republicans who say a wall's not needed here. They worry about the blow it would deal to the region, from threats to the environment and indigenous sites to impacts on the area's famously dark skies and on wild animals like black bears, which have made a recent return. It's all part of a $56 million tourism industry that Pineda says is now in jeopardy.
They're killing our economy with this wall because this area gets a lot of money from tourism. It's going to make everything change. It's going to be sad.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection tells NPR the agency will try to avoid or minimize impacts to the environment to the greatest extent possible in the areas where they plan to build walls. Historically, the area's rugged terrain has meant few people attempt to cross through the Big Bend, and since President Trump's second term, that number has fallen even further. In the first 3 months of the year, CBP's Big Bend sector saw a tenth of the nearly 4,500 apprehensions made in Texas's busiest sector.
We're not the number one crossing spot
Ronnie Dotson is the sheriff for Brewster County, home to Big Bend National Park, where CBP says it's no longer planning to construct 30-foot-tall steel fencing. Instead, the agency will now build vehicle barriers and patrol roads along the border.
We agree with border security. We agree there needs to be walls places. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that, but not here.
Dotson says the money being poured into border walls could be better spent. The price tag for just a single mile of border barrier in the Big Bend, over $17 million.
These numbers are mind-boggling. That type of money is generational changing.
Joanna McKenzie is the top elected official in Hudspeth County. In a joint letter, McKenzie and all of the county judges on the Texas-Mexico border wrote the government asking for a say in how border security takes shape in the places they know best.
Tell us, is this going to happen and we don't have a say in it? Okay, what can we do? What can we do? That's it. What can we do?
For some private landowners here, the answer's clear. They're willing to do whatever it takes, including filing their own lawsuits against the government. Raymond Skiles is a longtime wildlife biologist in the region and a landowner himself.
If this were to come to pass, it would be a rip through, you know, the treasured landscape of the Big Bend.
Sitting in his home in Alpine, Texas, Skiles looks at a map Customs and Border Protection sent him.
It'd be like taking a knife to the Mona Lisa and just cutting it in two and leaving that rent scar across it.
For Skiles, an imposing barrier through the Big Bend would be a painful reminder of what once was, an unwanted memorial to the place he calls home. For NPR News, I'm Carlos Morales in the Big Bend area of West Texas.
This is the West Texas Dispatch. In the last several weeks, more than 95,000 Texas families found out they would receive the school vouchers they had applied for. It's the first round of funding from the $1 billion education savings account system that became Texas law in 2025. KACU's Bailey Simon checked in with local private schools to find out how it is going to impact them.
Lawmakers set up four tiers for the funding. Top priority in Tier 1 goes to families who are beneath 500% of the federal poverty level and have a student with a disability. The second tier prioritizes households earning below 200% of the poverty level, about $66,000 for a family of four. Tier 3 is for households between 200 and 500%. The final tier is for families above that level and is capped at 20% of all program funds. Carrie Sanders, educator and director of Peak Christian Academy, says that while there's nothing wrong with public schools, it's important for families to have options.
I think that families around the country, but in Abilene, are just looking for something different. And we like to say that we gift families more time and time with their kids, time as a family, and time to just have a little bit more control.
SB2 gives families a little more than $10,000 for private school or about $2,000 for homeschooling expenses starting in the next school year. Peak's tuition ranges from around $4,000 to $5,000 per school year, significantly lower than the state's average of around $14,000. Sanders says she didn't feel like there was a broad support for ESAs in the Abilene community, but once it became law, local families did apply.
I don't think it's something that we saw a need for or necessarily saw it in a positive light. However, since it's gone through the process, I think families are accepting the fact that it has gotten passed. So can we take advantage of it and how can we get the funds from it?
More than 274,000 families from various demographics applied for the Texas Education Freedom Accounts Program. In this first round of funding, around 28,000 children with a disability and around 16,000 children with a disabled sibling qualified for funding. Kenley is a small private school in Abilene for kids with learning disabilities, such as ADHD, dyslexia, and dysgraphia. Rick Kaysen, director of Kenley School, says their goal is to get their students ready to return to a traditional school setting. The school has 13 or fewer students in each grade. Every classroom has a teacher and a teacher's assistant to help give each child the specialized attention they need to be successful.
Our 3rd and 4th grade teacher this year does a wonderful job. If the kids feel like they read better sitting under a table, she lets them sit under the table. Wherever we can reach them best is what we try to do.
Kaysen says 17 of the school's current 48 students will receive money from the School Choice Fund next year.
I think it's a game changer for our kids. It can be a game changer for us as a school, too.
Kenley rarely has to turn down students who would be a good fit for the school. However, Kaysen says interest from families looking to give their kids special attention with the help of school vouchers could push Kenley to their max capacity of 60 students. Peak Christian Academy has also seen an increase in those interested in enrolling. Director Carrie Sanders says they've heard from more families than ever before.
So I can only attribute that to definitely changing demands educationally, but also the fact that there is money out there definitely draws more people in.
However, Sanders says more interest doesn't mean that Peak will be able to take more students. The admissions process is very selective, and they want to keep their 14-to-1 student-to-teacher ratio. Statewide demand far exceeded the available funding. In the second tier of funding, for children from households with an annual income at or below 200% of the federal poverty level, 51,000 students received funding, but another 20,000 were put on a wait list. Another 132,000 families from tiers 3 and 4 also ended up being on the wait list. Those families and many others will be watching to find out what next year's application cycle will look like. I'm Bailey Simon in Abilene.
And we've got another blast from the not-too-distant past. Athena Crum, once Athena Triantopoulos, brought a sunny presentation on air to her shifts, and she helped us cover everything from elections to arts and culture, and she helped KACU serve this community.
Hello, KACU. My name is Athena Crum, formerly Athena Triantopoulos, and if I sound familiar to you, that's because I worked for KACU way back in 2023. As I think back on my time as a student, KACU stands out as being one of the most professionally and experientially formative opportunities I had. Everything from on-air hosting to collecting news around the Abilene area and attending local events impacted my learning experience. I always loved when our annual fundraiser rolled around because that meant we would have new and exciting guests from around town join us at the station. I truly got to enmesh myself in the Abilene community and meet so many of the amazing people who live here, many of you who may even be listening right now. KACU gave me opportunities to learn about my community through reporting on stories like the opening of the pedestrian tunnels in the Cultural District and the city council elections. These stories and so many others made me fall in love with Abilene even more, and they sharpened my professional skills. Now that I've graduated, I am back at my alma mater working in the alumni department. KACU helped shape me into the person I am today and equipped me with the skills necessary to do the work I'm doing. But I'm not the only one who has been positively impacted. KACU has brought in and taught so many students in its 4 decades. KACU shares accurate news and insightful information to encourage lifelong learning in a public space that everyone can enjoy. They highlight diverse ideas and voices and encourage community through talking about current events and personal reflection. I have personally witnessed voices come to life and stories come into light at KACU. So, thank you and happy 40th KACU. Cheers to many, many more. As always, if you'd like to support KACU and the work they've been doing for students and local news reporting for 4 decades now, click on that green button at the top of the screen at kacu.org. My name's Athena Crum. It was so good to talk to you again. Thank you for supporting KACU.
It's time for West Texas Roots. Most people can't imagine packing up everything they have and traveling across the plains on a horse-drawn wagon on the whim of a stranger. Charlotte Wester is one of those people who have a familiar connection to those settlers and whose great-great-grandfather convinced her family to move to Fisher County.
My grandmother Birdie was born in Rocky, Oklahoma, when Oklahoma was a territory. Her grandpa came down to Fisher County, county line, and said, y'all come on down, we've got some land in the Longhorn Valley. So no cars. So they walked and used a wagon and came all the way down and first landed in Buffalo Gap. Then they went on out to Fisher County. Now she was only about 7 or 8 years old, and her mother had a terrible disease called milk leg. And so as the oldest daughter, she had to learn to cook for all her older brothers and sisters. Got married at 15 and had 9 children. And many of those children became professionals, doctors, lawyers, professors. But it's a wonderful thing having a root that deep here in West Texas. Our grandpa, he had 13 children, 9 in the first bunch, and then he remarried a young woman and had 4 more. So he had found this valley, and it was beautiful because it had pecan trees, and the way the river came through in the rain, it would fertilize the pecan trees. So he had a good cash crop. Can you say it 3 times? And he raised all those boys and girls, and my daddy, who was his grandson, grew up just down the way from him. So I've got all these stories from my daddy. He's gone on to glory, but I remember the stories. By accident, we drove from Rocky, Oklahoma down to Buffalo Gap. And I was just thinking about that poor little girl walking and walking and walking. And I'm sure it took weeks, because that's a pretty good, 20 miles a day is about the most you can do, and that's a good thing. But no, they didn't tell you. She told more stories about after she got here. Well, there's a book that my uncle Luther wrote about the one-room schoolrooms in that area. And I think it's out of print, but he taught in Christian University up in Dallas area, like Church of Christ. Anyway, that's where he was professor at of history. So he wrote a book about it. And by my mama's side, her daddy was born 1891. And he became a teacher, and his brother and his sister-in-law became teachers, and they were teachers in these one-room schoolrooms. So we've got a farm still, a ranch, that we've had in our family over 100 years. So I'm at home here. This is my home. We are very brave. We went to be missionaries in South America for 36 years in Ecuador, so we're back now. So that's why I think I'm so nostalgic back home. Yeah, we go back 4 or 5 times a year and do projects to help the people, get potable water for them. It's a wonderful life. Now I'm nearly 69, and you just slow down. You don't realize it. Right now I don't feel like I slow down, but when you start getting back into that rhythm, it takes it out of you. So we go back like 3 or 4 times a year. We're now working with a village of indigenous. They're very interesting people, but their water's been contaminated. Their wells are drying up. So we're getting them potable water. But in the meantime, they're starting churches. They're reaching out to the community. And we're just kind of in the background, do good, keep going, do good, keep going, and teaching them when we can. So that's the way it should be. Letting go and letting God. So yeah. And my grandpa, who started all this, was a strong Christian man. He was a strong Christian man. He liked his children to be fruitful. And my grandma Birdie had 9. Okay, I'll get you the name of it. So he was very proud of Birdie. Isn't that a neat name? Birdie. Well, her name was really Lucy Alberta. They called her B-I-R-D-I-E, just because that's who she was. Little bitty brown-headed little girl, brown eyes, I kind of look like her. So yeah, it's fun.
We recorded Charlotte Webster's story of how her family moved to the big country and her yearly Ecuador mission trips at the Taylor County Expo Center. This is the West Texas Dispatch. Summer is just around the corner, and as the weather is warming up, locals and tourists have been creating extra traffic at the Abilene Farmers Market. Not only is the weekly market a fun activity for families, the vendors' farms are in peak producing season with lots and lots of veggies. KACU's Allison Diaz shares with us what makes the market so special and vital to the Abilene community.
On a recent Saturday, the Abilene Farmers Market was bustling with vendors, customers, and the hum of trucks and trailers. Each week, more than 20 vendors set up their goods, and whether they are seasoned or green vendors, each has a deep love for the market, their farms, and the customers they serve.
This is my 10th year at the Abilene Farmers Market.
23 years.
About 7 years.
34 years.
There are a wide variety of items for sale each week, from handcrafted goods and artisan breads and sweet treats to locally grown produce. Higher than usual rainfall has helped local farmers, and right now there are plenty of vegetables and plants available. At the market, shoppers can find a variety of veggies, jams, honey, bread, potatoes, and plants. Vegetables that were out on the market on Saturday include lots of carrots, potatoes, onions, beets, snow peas, turnip greens, broccoli, and cabbage. Pat Caraway with Caraway Farm Fresh Kitchen, based just outside of Eastland, gushes about her fresh vegetables and gives a sneak peek of what is to come.
Today I have new potatoes for the first time. I just dug them yesterday. And my broccoli has just came in, so I have some big heads of broccoli. The cabbage is fresh too. I cut it yesterday. The onions are growing well.
Caraway says business has been picking up in recent weeks, and she expects that to continue as more crops ripen.
Green beans are about to come off, and the squash and the zucchini will be making soon. The tomatoes are growing, so y'all just remember us. We're here.
Every Saturday morning, the vendors set up their goods at the Abilene Farmers Market in the parking lot between Frontier Texas and Front Porch Coffee Company and Bakery. The market, which is certified by the state of Texas, opens each week at 8 a.m. and serves shoppers until noon, or until the vendors sell out. The True Local Foods stand guarantees chemical-free vegetables. Based in Taylor County, True Local grows produce in a regenerative way by using natural fertilizers that don't include chemical pesticides. Landry and Megan Meeks serve customers with the help of their daughter, June, who handed bags to customers and helped her mom take payments. Landry says that they feel what they provide is important for people who care about eating as healthy as possible.
You know, why does that matter? Like, most conventional produce is laden with chemicals. Hopefully gonna, you know, continue to grow what we're doing and advocate for regenerative agriculture and sustainable agriculture.
The gardens and small farms will continue to produce vegetables and fruits until fall comes around September. That's when the market transitions into a slightly different shopping experience. Through the winter, the farmers market still serves the community locally crafted goods. Several vendors offer shoppers goods that follow health and beauty trends, like a current attraction to tallow-based skincare. That's what shoppers find at Dry Creek Tallow Booth. Megan and Matthew Fox source all the tallow for their products locally. Megan gives a crash course on the usefulness of tallow, explaining why it's become so popular.
What man thinks is the trash of the cow, God's like, let me show you how perfect it is, right? The beef fat, once you render it, purify it, it gets filtered. When it is done, it is this beautiful skincare product. It has vitamins A, D, E, and K, and that's without us adding anything to it, and it mimics your skin's natural oil. So when you're putting the tallow on your skin's like, oh, hey, I know you. It's pretty neat how God can work.
Dry Creek Tallow uses the tallow for everything, from body scrubs to chapsticks, moisturizers, lotions, and deodorants. Across the way, the Supple Sasquatch booth offers beard oil. 17-year-old Landry LaFrance has been running the business since last September when she took it from her father.
So our original scent is our orange sandalwood. So that is the scent that started it all. And it just has grown from there. In September, I started running it because he got a new job and he didn't have enough time to take care of it. And so it's my baby now. I love it.
Awesome. She makes and sells beard oil, beard balm, and mustache wax. LaFrance says her handcrafted goods are a better option for men's skincare and beard maintenance.
Are we getting some carrots?
No.
Oh, yes we are. And some cinnamon rolls.
And it's not just produce and skincare that shoppers are hunting for. Lots of them seek out their favorite baked goods, picking up sourdough bread and cinnamon rolls. And true fans know they have to show up early. Vivi Barker, owner of Bakes for Angels, says she often sells out of most of her award-winning baked goods before 10 a.m.
Pretty much it's a sourdough bakery with breads and croissants, and the mission of our business is to help people who are grieving, and also my grief as well. So
Barker lost her brother to gun violence in 2022, and she started the bakery in part as a tribute to him. Not an early bird? The farmhouse coffee trailer owned by Shelby Bordofsky offers caffeinated pick-me-ups to shoppers who like to stroll the booths while sipping a coffee, tea, or lemonade.
Yeah, it stays busy. Community support is awesome. You know, we love being here and we're thankful for all of our customers.
Gratitude is common among the vendors and the organizers. The Abilene Farmers Market manager, Becky Leverne, says she's thankful for the community and the increased traffic at the market this time of the year.
Everyone here at the market raises, makes, or produces what they're selling, so it's truly supporting your neighbors when you come here.
Becky says seeing the crowds grow means more support for the community, which helps each small business owner. The Clark family are regulars at the Abilene Farmers Market. Mom and Dad, Kaylee and Dalton Clark, with young Evelyn Bay and Trevor, were decked out in all pink on a recent Saturday. Kaylee says that they make an effort to try to come every weekend.
We love supporting local businesses, so yeah, that's our goal. We want to just grow our own things and help our local businesses as much as we can. So, yeah. What do you love about the farmers market?
I like getting treats.
Over the 44 years the market has been operating, vendors, organizers, and shoppers have enjoyed a strong sense of community. Shoppers enjoy getting to know the farmers and artisans. They connect with neighbors, and they feel good about being a part of the local economy. I'm Allison Diaz in Abilene.
This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. We're here each Wednesday at noon. Plan to join us and tell a friend. And if your friend isn't able to tune in Wednesdays at noon, you let them know they can subscribe to that podcast. It's available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can also find it on the KACU mobile app. Our executive producer is Heather Claiborne. We also had help from producers Shayla Conley and Caleb Leger. Calvin Claiborne is our digital editor. A special thanks, as always, to JC Gamble, who wrote our theme music. I'm George Levesque.